From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. Today is the 8th annual World AIDS Day. Gay men have been hit hard by the epidemic. Gay writers have chronicled the catastrophe. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear some of the extraordinary poems about illness and loss that have been written through the epidemic. And we'll talk with writers and with editors who helped shape the literature of AIDS. A literary response to the AIDS epidemic, today on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. NATO has agreed to send the first 2,600 troops of the NATO peacekeeping force to Bosnia. The contingent includes several hundred U.S. soldiers. They could arrive in Bosnia as early as tomorrow. The French commander of UN forces in Sarajevo has openly criticized the Dayton peace agreement and warned that it might be unworkable. The French government has disassociated itself from the statement. From Paris, Lynn Terry has more.
A French commander in Sarajevo, General Jean-René Bachelet, told a French newspaper that the Dayton Accord was unworkable. He said when it's put in place, Serbs in the capital would be unprotected. Sarajevo is due to be controlled by the Muslim-led government. He said if Serb militias were dissolved, as the accord says they'll be, Serbs would flee in mass exodus and burn their homes in a scorched earth policy. Meanwhile, he said French peacekeepers would be stuck directing traffic while the capital burned. The French government has voiced similar concerns. President Jacques Chirac has written to President Bill Clinton demanding that the Serbs in Sarajevo be protected. However, today a defense ministry official said the French commander was speaking for himself and not on behalf of the government. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Another rape case allegedly involving U.S. troops on Okinawa is being investigated by the military. A Marine at a base called Camp Hansen is accused of raping a female Marine on Wednesday. The rape of a 12-year-old schoolgirl on Okinawa in September, allegedly by three U.S. servicemen, has sparked demonstrations in Japan against the U.S. military presence on Okinawa. The most important effort to privatize public education in the U.S. has ended. The Baltimore Public School Board has terminated its contract with Education Alternatives Incorporated. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The school board's vote to end its five-year contract with EAI was unanimous. One reason was money, and no one was angrier about it than parents.
The only thing that they're concerned about is money.
Money.
And it's a shame that it's always our children that they're picking on, and we're sick and tired of it.
A $32 million shortfall in the school budget this year meant the city could not continue to pay EAI the money it said it needed to educate children, about $6,000 per student. City officials had argued for months that that was way too much, especially when you consider that students' test scores in reading and math at all nine of the schools that the company managed for the past 3 years were lackluster. EAI made headlines in 1992 claiming that it could take the same amount of money Baltimore was spending on its failing schools, turn them around dramatically, and make a profit. I'm Claudio Sanchez reporting.
President Clinton appealed for peace in Ireland in a speech before the Irish Parliament today. Mr. Clinton said no people are more deserving of a bright future than the Irish. The president also spoke to a cheering crowd in Dublin. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 3.5 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Secret Service arrested a man claiming to be a preacher near the White House today after they found a rifle, knives, and ammunition in his car. The man was stopped after he drove into a restricted zone on the stretch of Pennsylvania Avenue near the White House that was closed off for security reasons. Argentina's state news agency reports that authorities have arrested about a dozen people in connection with last year's attack on a Jewish community center. NPR's Nina Teicholz reports.
The state agency Telem says authorities arrested at least 2 soldiers and 10 civilians following a number of raids in and around the capital city of Buenos Aires. Argentina's assistant security chief, Alejandro Perez Carrega, confirmed that police, the army, and state intelligence agencies carried out the raids jointly. They included the country's largest military base, Campo del Mayo, and were ordered by federal judge Juan José Galeano. He's in charge of investigating last July's car bombing of the Jewish Community Center. It killed 86 people, injured more than 300, and is considered to be the bloodiest peacetime attack against a Jewish facility ever. Although in the past, police have arrested many suspects, all but one have later been released and the charges dropped. American and Argentine officials have consistently blamed Islamic militants for the attack, but today's arrests seem to confirm strong suggestions from the start that Argentine nationals were involved. This is Nina Teicholz reporting.
Oregon Senator Mark Hatfield has just announced that he will retire after his current term in office. Hatfield held a news conference in Silverton, Oregon. He tipped his hand yesterday in a meeting with GOP leaders when he indicated that he would probably not be running. Hatfield is a moderate Republican who has served in the Senate for nearly 30 years. A federal judge in Oregon has sentenced two former followers of the Bhagwan Shri Rajneesh to 5 years in prison for conspiring to kill a U.S. attorney in 1985. The attorney led a grand jury investigation into charges of immigration fraud at the Bhagwan's vast commune in Oregon. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is World AIDS Day, a day to educate about the epidemic and to remember the people we lost to it. The writer John Preston, who died of AIDS a couple of years ago, once said, "AIDS is not a gay disease. It is, however, a catastrophe for gay men." This catastrophe is being chronicled in a growing body of AIDS literature. Some of it is quite extraordinary. As literary editor Michael Denneny has said, the writers took on the job of sounding the alarm, mobilizing the community politically and spiritually, and delineating the shape of the disaster. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from some of the poets who have found words for the grief and anger that have left so many of us dumbstruck. Poet Mark Doty lost his lover Wally to AIDS nearly 2 years ago. They were together 12 years. Doty writes about their relationship in his new book of poems called Atlantis. Doty's earlier collection of poems, My Alexandria, won a 1994 National Book Critics Circle Award and was a National Book Award finalist. I spoke with Doty a year ago, and he told me that during the last year of his lover Wally's life, he had a viral brain infection which gradually paralyzed him below the waist.
Every few weeks, there would be something new that Wally couldn't do. Until quite late in his life, he would have trouble finding the word that he wanted, and after a while, he was unable to feed himself. Each of these new limitations would mean a new level of loss. I came to feel that losing him was not an event exactly, not a moment, not a line to be crossed, but rather a gradual process.
You have a poem called New Dog about getting a dog for Wally when he was sick. Would you read the poem to us? But before you do, I think this is a new poem.
It is. It's one of the poems of this group that I found myself unable to write during Wally's life. And it was really only about 6 months later that I could see that the sequence I had written felt unfinished, felt unresolved to me. And what was missing was the kind of gesture toward life, towards ongoingness that he had made at a very late point in his life when just about a month before he died, he got very excited about adopting a new dog. Jimmy and Tony can't keep Dino, their cocker spaniel. Tony's too sick. The daily walks, more pressure than pleasure. One more obligation that can't be met. And though we already have a dog, Wally wants to adopt, wants something small and golden to sleep next to him and lick his face. He's paralyzed now from the waist down. Whatever's ruining him, moving upward, and we don't know how much longer he'll be able to pet a dog. How many men want another attachment, just as they're leaving the world? Wally sits up nights and says, "I'd like some lizards, a talking bird, some fish, a little rat." So after I drive to Jimmy and Tony's in the village and they meet me at the door and say, "We can't go through with it. We can't give up our dog," I drive to the shelter just to look. And there is Bo, bounding and practically boundless, one brass concatenation of tongue and tail, unmediated energy, too big, wild, perfect. He not only licks Wally's face, but bathes every irreplaceable inch of his head. And though Wally can no longer feed himself, he can lift his hand and bring it to rest on the rough gilt flanks when they are, for a moment, still. I have never seen a touch so deliberate. It isn't about grasping. The hand itself seems almost blurred now, softened, though tentative only because so much will must be summoned, such attention brought to the work, which is all he is now. This gesture toward the restless splendor, the unruly, the golden, the animal, the new.
Mark, where is the dog now?
Well, Bo's with me. At the time, I thought, well, we're doing something here that is a little bit crazy. There's a man in the house who's terminally ill, and of course his care was tremendously demanding. And it really did not seem like a reasonable time to adopt a 3-year-old golden retriever who was not particularly well-trained. And what happened after Wally's death was that I discovered that Bo was, in fact, Wally's last gift to me because he became a wonderful presence in my life, a source of energy, a source of surprise, something to get me out of the house at times when I really didn't want to go, a set of needs that I could meet at a time when Wally was no longer there to have his needs met, and I didn't feel I could particularly pay a lot of attention to my own or even be clear about what my needs were. There was a dog to walk and a dog to feed and a presence who needed my attention, and that was very important in getting me through a difficult time.
Did you ever have a sense of what you should be feeling and what you should be writing, only to find that you were feeling and writing things that were completely different?
Oh, sometimes I felt a kind of anger, a kind of helplessness welling up when I would sit down to write, which I did not want to confront. It seemed so necessary during Wally's illness to find ways to be in control, to find ways to manage, both to meet his needs, to deal with the many other people who were suddenly involved in our lives and in our home working to take care of him. And I felt I needed to be able to hold all that together at a time when I also very much needed to fall apart. And because writing is always an invitation to feeling, I would find that when I sat down to do my own work, I would often begin to unravel in a way that I didn't want to face. I think that's why for a long time I couldn't finish these poems. They would threaten to completely overwhelm me.
I'm going to ask you to read another poem. This is a poem about death. But I guess from the title, which is Bill's story, that this is not your story.
That's right.
This is told from somebody else's point of view. I'm not even sure it's about AIDS. So tell us something about whose story this is.
This poem is the story of a friend of mine who lost his sister to the epidemic very early on, early in the 80s, at a point when, of course, we knew even less than the little that we know today. So Annie experienced a sudden and wildly deepening episode of dementia, which at that point was completely not understood. The poem wants to tell Bill's story about the end of his sister's life and also wants to think about the way that we conceive dying, the kind of I'm afraid sometimes all too convenient or easy ways we think about going into the light, the way we think about the experience of death, and how we as the living, as the caregivers, might assist in that, which I think sometimes becomes a little too simple. Towards the end of Wally's life, one of his nurses gave us a Xeroxed handout called How to Prepare for Approaching Death. And as well-meaning as that gesture was, it also completely shocked me to, in its kind of pomposity, you know, the notion that that someone understood what approaching death was like and the ways that we might prepare for it, as opposed to honoring the immensity, the unknowability of the mystery that confronted us. So I think that kind of concern is at the heart of this poem. It's also sometimes, too, you know, a wonderful escape to leave one's own voice behind and at least pretend to speak in someone else's. So this is called Bill's Story. When my sister came back from Africa, we didn't know at first how everything had changed. After a while, Annie bought men's and boys' clothes in all sizes and filled her closets with little or huge things she could never wear. Then she took to buying out theatrical shops, rental places on the skids, sweeping in and saying, "I'll take everything." Dementia was the first sign of something we didn't even have a name for in 1978. She was just growing stranger. All those clothes, the way she'd dress me up when I came to visit. It was like we could go back to playing together again and get it right. She was a performance artist, and she did her best work then, taking the clothes to clubs, talking, putting them all on, talking. It was years before she was in the hospital, and my mother needed something to hold on to, some way to be helpful. So she read a book called Deathing, a cheap, ugly verb if ever I heard one, and took its advice to heart. She'd sit by the bed and say, "Annie, look for the light. Look for the light." It was plain that Anne did not wish to be distracted by these instructions. She came to, though she was nearly gone then, and looked at our mother with what was almost certainly annoyance. "It's a white light," Mom said. And this struck me as incredibly presumptuous, as if the light we'd all go into would be just the same. Maybe she wanted to give herself up to indigo or red. If we can barely even speak to each other, living so separately, how can we all die the same? I used to take the train to the hospital, and sometimes the only empty seats would be the ones that faced backwards. I'd sit there and watch where I'd been waver and blur out. And finally, I liked it, seeing what you've left get more beautiful, less specific. Maybe her light was all that gabardine and flannel, khaki and navy and silks and stripes. If you take everything, you've got to let everything go. Dying must take more attention than I ever imagined. Just when she'd compose herself and seem fixed on the work before her, Mother would fret, trying to help her just one more time, look for the light. Until I took my mother's arm and told her wherever I was in the world, I would come back, no matter how difficult it was to reach her, if I heard her calling. "Shut up, Mother," I said, and Annie died.
That's a really powerful poem about not following the rule book.
Thank you. It's hard for me to be sure now how much of that poem is really Bill's story and how much is my elaboration upon his story. I know that the imagination gets a hold of anyone's material and does with it what it will.
Were you with Wally when he died?
Yes, I was.
And did you feel like, "Well, I know what to do, I'll just do what I do," or were you fretting about what to do?
It during the last month, it became clear that there was not a great deal of time left for Wally, at least not a great deal of time for him to be conscious. My great fear for him was that his paralysis would result in being, physically completely immobilized, but nonetheless aware, which did not happen. During the last few weeks, he was like a person who's had a stroke. Part of his body, half of his body, would not cooperate. He couldn't find the words he wanted. And during the last week, as his breathing began to change and as a kind of, I don't know what to call it, a kind of sort of gentle, muffled ease began to settle over him, it was clear to me what was happening. And that last week was a very important time for us together. One of his nurses had wanted him to begin a rather large dose of morphine right around that time, I think on the theory that morphine makes it easier for people to die. and certainly can make it easier for the people around the dying person to deal with what's happening. But he wasn't in pain, or at least in no pain that he was expressing. And there was a kind of tranquility and ease in his face that made me want to resist that prescription. And I'm so glad that I did, because it meant that he and I had a week together that was a time of sitting together quietly, and sometimes I was reading and sometimes just looking at him, playing music for him that he liked, spending time with both the dogs, even the impossibly obstreperous new golden retriever, having the cats on the hospital bed with him that we had brought into our room, just being quiet together. He would sleep during the day, he would wake up and chatter or say nothing. He would laugh at his own inability to find the words that he wanted. He would ramble a little, and sometimes he would just lie very quietly. That time also meant that his mother and some of his brothers and sisters were able to see him before he died. And over the last 2 days, when his breathing changed very dramatically and it became clear that it was dying, that he was dying, it meant that the two of us could sit together and I could pay attention to that. It meant that when he could no longer move his head and no longer speak, I could keep myself in his line of vision and bring the dogs into his line of vision and see a reaction in his eyes that meant that, though he wasn't talking anymore, he knew that we were there with him. And it meant that that I could talk to him as he was going and be inside of that experience with him.
It must have been really good for you to be able to be there.
I can't imagine what it would have been like to lose him without being able to participate in that. Because there really was a kind of, oh, this is going to sound odd, there was a kind of beauty, a kind of power about watching that transformation. I don't know what I believe happens to us after we die, but I know now that it's something of which I'm not afraid, and that there is an enormous grace and dignity that becomes visible in us in that moment of our greatest extremity. And having seen that in him, I'm sure is what carried me through the first few months without him. You know, and then after a while, that sense of having been in some way blessed to be with him then faded, and I was faced with the plain old misery of grief and being without him. But the experience of being a part of that most, in a way, most profound moment in his life carried me through many months.
Mark, how is your health?
Oh, well, as far as I know, I'm fine. When Wally and I took the HIV test in 1989, he tested positive, I tested negative, and I haven't tested again since.
Well, I wish you good health. And
thank you, Terry.
Thank you for reading your wonderful poems for us.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Mark Doty recorded 1 year ago. His new book of poems is called Atlantis. He has a memoir called Heaven's Coast, which will be published this winter. This semester, he's teaching at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. This is Fresh Air. Last year on World AIDS Day, one of our guests was poet Essex Hempel, who wrote about being black and gay. He had appeared in Marlon Riggs' film Tongues Untied and had edited anthologies of gay poets. Just 3 weeks ago, Essex Hempel died of complications related to AIDS. He was 38. On this World AIDS Day, we remember him with an excerpt of his interview and reading. He read a piece he wrote in June 1993, after he discovered how low his T-cell count had fallen. T-cells are white blood cells that protect the blood from infection. This is an excerpt of Vital Signs.
Some of the T cells I am without are not here through my own fault. I didn't lose all of them foolishly, and I didn't lose all of them erotically. Some of the missing T cells were lost to racism, a well-known transmittable disease. Some were lost to poverty because there was no money to do something about the plumbing before the pipes burst and the room flooded. Homophobia killed quite a few, but so did my rage and my pointed furies. So did the wars at home and the wars within. So did the drugs I took to remain calm, cool, collected. There are T-cells lying dead by the roadside, slain by the guise of friendship, the pettiness and jealousy of minds and talent in the process of wasting to nothingness due to envy, gazing into other yards instead of looking closely at and tending to their own. There are T-cells sacrificed between the love and anger my mother and I hold for one another. T-cells that have simply exploded due to the decibel of our screeching. There are countless wasted T-cells between my father and I, the result of painful subterranean silences that I cannot resolve with only 23 T-cells, nor should I really be expected to, nor should I try, since it was his violence I witnessed and remained scarred from. I am forced to remember him in certain ways, to always see him punching and pushing, slapping and yelling, not because I want to, I just haven't learned how to make so many scars into things of beauty, and I don't know if I ever will.
I'm interested in the ending of that passage about making scars into things of beauty. Do you feel like in confronting AIDS, this is what you should really be trying to do, is to reconcile with people and to make scars into things of beauty?
In some ways, I've been faced with that. In some ways, I allow that you cannot revisit some sites, some emotional sites, some personal sites. Some things will forever be the tragedies, big and small, that they were. The only thing I do know is that forgiving is as divine as saying thanks. I am sure of that. So I get up every day thankful, you know, just thankful.
Essex Hempel recorded 1 year ago. He died 3 weeks ago of complications related to AIDS. I'm Terry Gross, and this is a World AIDS Day edition of Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on this World AIDS Day, we hear more from the poets who have given voice to the grief and anger others find nearly impossible to express. We'll hear from an editor who's worked with many writers who have died, and one writer reflects on the staggering toll of the epidemic on his circle of friends.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this World AIDS Day, we're featuring some of the extraordinary literature that has been written in the wake of the epidemic. Michael Denneny says this literature may have no literary parallel. It's as if war poems were being written and mimeographed in the trenches, then distributed to soldiers to read under fire. Denneny has edited some of this literature. Many of the writers he's worked with have died of AIDS. Denneny was an editor at St. Martin's Press for 17 years, where he had his own gay imprint, Stonewall Editions. He's now at Crown. Last year, I asked him if the nature of his relationship to a writer changes if that writer gets sick.
It puts you under enormous psychological pressure. I mean, I never would have anticipated 20 years ago, going into publishing, constantly worrying about whether I could get a book out before the writer died, which has become a regular problem. Most of the times we make it, but not always. So it puts enormous pressure on the whole process. And then there are, you know, emergencies. I mean, when Randy Schultz was finishing Conduct Unbecoming, he collapsed. Basically, he had almost finished the book, but was immobilized in a hospital for weeks. And I essentially had to fly out there and, with the assistance he'd set up and with his approval, sort of finish the book to get it out in time so that it was relevant to the fairly asinine debate that we had on gays in the military.
Well, it must put you in a funny position because on the one hand, I know you're probably really close to some of the writers you work with. And as a person close to a writer, you want to urge them to take it easy if they're sick and to not work. And as their editor and as someone who really cares about the body of work they're leaving behind, you want to urge them, finish the book, leave it behind complete if you possibly can.
Well, with the case of Randy, he had basically taken great risks with his health in order to finish this book. He was so committed to finishing the book, it had taken precedence in his thinking over his own health. Or with John Preston last spring, John actually was in a coma for 2 weeks, and I thought that was the end. And suddenly he came out of it, gave me a call, which startled the hell out of me. I said, John, I never thought I was going to speak to you again. And he said, I can't die in peace until we get the contract done for Franny, which I thought was a perfect John Preston. I said, John, you're really pushing it this time. But we had 3 days, and we managed to get all the legal niceties handled. He managed to revise Franny. He signed the contracts and, I believe, died within 8 hours.
Wow.
It was just a stunning event, but clearly he was totally committed to getting this, his favorite book, out in a new edition and in cloth.
Well, I guess there couldn't be a better illustration of how important a writer's work is to them.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever say to one of your writers, look, don't worry about the book, take care of your health first? I mean, which do you feel more loyal to, their health or to their work?
I think basically being loyal to the writers, you have to allow them to make the decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's generally the case. Various people respond in various ways, even if they're not writers. I mean, you know, some go into a totally health mode. Some would prefer to live their life the way they're living now, even if it would shorten their life. And I think you just have to respect the autonomy of those decisions. If these are your friends, I mean, whether you agree with them or not, who knows what, you know, what one would do in those circumstances oneself. So you sort of, I think the duty of a friend is simply to, or an editor for that matter, is to support the person in whatever decision they make.
Have you been in the position where a writer has died before they were able to complete the book and then you had to decide what to do with the manuscript?
Yeah, actually, one of the most unusual cases that I know of was a guy named Peter McGee, who had written 2 novels that I had published about AIDS, clearly quite autobiographical. The second novel, actually, he died within a week of getting the contract. So I edited it with his long-term lover, Doug Wilson. And PETA had left 2 pages of notes behind about the third book in this trilogy he had always intended to write. And to my astonishment, Doug wrote the novel. I thought this was a very bad idea. You know, it just does not sound likely. It doesn't sound like it's going to have a good outcome. Doug had never particularly been a writer, although he'd been PETA's first reader and sort of editor. But he did an incredible job. And it's in PETA's voice. The structure is very similar. It fits into the trilogy beautifully. It's called A Labor of Love, which is perfectly appropriate. And Doug himself died within 5 days of sending me the manuscript.
Oh, wow.
But as a literary event, I've never quite seen something like that. As, you know, sort of the last thing you can do for your lover, you write a novel that finishes his trilogy. It was quite remarkable.
Because of your reputation as an editor of a lot of gay fiction and nonfiction, and as an editor who's worked with a lot of people with AIDS, are there people with AIDS, hopeful writers, who come to you thinking that you will almost automatically be a sympathetic figure for them, but you find that their writing isn't all that good and you have to turn them down? I wonder what it's like to be in that position.
Difficult, because, yeah, that is exactly what happens. I see an enormous amount of... especially diaries and reflective or philosophical books, simply because many people in this type of crisis situation find the need to turn inward and to reflect. And it's very useful to do that in writing, I think. And it's very difficult because I think you have to read them seriously and you have to give people some kind of real response. I mean, after all, usually they've spent a year or two, you know, doing this. And there's no question 90-95% of it would not be publishable in the sense that it's more testimonial. It's more private. I don't know if I'm articulating that well. It's not that they're necessarily badly written, but they tend to be not written for the public. Even that doesn't get what I'm trying to say.
Merely personal. It's about them, but it's not...
It's about them, and it's about their trying to figure out, right, you know, what's important in life and et cetera, et cetera. So you see a great deal of it, and what's difficult is you don't, or I don't feel right, you know, reading 2 pages and sending it back with a form letter. So it ends up taking a great deal of time. But, like, 95% of the novels one reads are not publishable. I would say the same proportion is true of the AIDS writing that I get.
Well, you know how people say doctors shouldn't get too close to their patients, in part because patients sometimes die, and you can't, you know, you can't go through that with everyone. You're in that position as an editor now. I mean, you have writers who are dying, and you must ask yourself how close you can allow yourself to get so that you can keep on with your work.
Yeah, but I don't think you can withdraw, especially if, you know, if these are people who have been friends of yours for years. It's just like as if they were friends to begin with. I mean, you can't distance or withdraw from that. You just go through it. I mean, it's part of the bad times we're living in, I guess. It does get wearing. It does get wearing. I actually edited Randy Schultz's second book, Band Played On, which was all about AIDS, almost entirely in a hospital room. One of my ex-lovers was dying, and I made a deal with the nurses at Roosevelt, I guess visiting hours were over at 8:30, and he didn't like to be alone. So I made a deal with the nurses that if I got in before 8:30, I could stay till 1 or 2. And since he was comatose most of the time, I figured, you know, I could edit there as well as I could edit at home, and then I would be there if he woke up. But I must admit, after about 7 weeks, it was really getting me down.
Well, I'm sure that's a remarkable understatement, that it was getting you down.
Yeah, it was like everywhere you turned.
Your lover, the book you were editing, all about AIDS.
Mm-hmm. It was a grim time.
What do you think the place of AIDS literature will be after the epidemic?
I think it'll probably be the founding literature of gay culture and the gay community in a very odd way. I mean, in the 70s, when I first got involved in publishing, you know, gay books, gay magazines, etc., there were many heated discussions about whether there was such a thing as gay culture or not. I mean, even by people who today would be considered representatives of gay culture, like Edmund White or Ethan Mordden, there are many late-night discussions where even those guys sometimes took the position that there was no such thing as a specifically gay culture or gay literature. I don't think that will be a position many people will take 10 years from now. And to some extent, I think because this historical event or the, you know, this historical threat to the whole community so mobilized the resources of the writers, and they did create this literature, which I think is quite remarkable, I think they sort of put that, made that a moot question.
Michael Denneny is a senior editor at Crown Publishers. This is Fresh Air. Writers who die of AIDS sometimes leave their unfinished work in the hands of trusted friends. Poet David Trinidad has edited a forthcoming volume of poems by his friend, Tim Dugos, who died of AIDS in 1990. Dugos was a contributing editor of the gay paper Christopher Street. Last year, we invited David Trinidad to read a poem by Dugos called DOA.
DOA. You knew who I was when I walked in the door. You thought that I was dead. Well, I am dead. A man can walk and talk and even breathe and still be dead. Edmund O'Brien is perspiring and chewing up the scenery in my favorite film noir, DOA. I can't stop watching, can't stop relating. When I walked down Columbus to Endicott last night to pick up Tor's new novel, I felt the eyes of every Puerto Rican teen, crackhead, yuppie couple focus on my cane and makeup. You're dead, they seemed to say in chorus. Somewhere in a dark bar years ago, I picked up luminous poisoning. My eyes glowed as I sipped my drink. After that, there was no cure, no turning back. I had to find out what was gnawing at my gut. The hardest parts, not even the physical effects. Stumbling like a drunk, Edmund O'Brien was one of Hollywood's most active lushes, through 40 sets, alternating sweats and fevers, reptilian spots on face and scalp. It's having to say goodbye, like the scene where soundtrack violins go crazy as O'Brien gives his last embrace to his girlfriend come Girl Friday, Paula, played by Pamela Britton. They're filmdom's least likely lovers, the squat and jowly alky and the homely, fundamentally talentless actress who would hit the height of her fame as the pillhead acting landlady on My Favorite Martian 15 years in the future. I don't have 15 years, and neither does Edmund O'Brien. He has just enough time to tell Paula how much he loves her, then to drive off in a convertible for the showdown with his killer. I'd like to have a showdown, too, if I could figure out which pistol-packing, brilliant-teened, and ruthless villain in a houndstooth overcoat took my life. Lust, addiction, being in the wrong place at the wrong time? That's not the whole story. Absolute fidelity to the truth of what I felt, open to the moment, and in every case a kind of love. All of the above brought me to this tottering, self-conscious state. Pneumonia, emaciation, grisly cancer, no future, heart of gold, passionate engagement with a great B film, a glorious summer afternoon in which to pick up the ripest plum tomatoes of the year and prosciutto for the feast I'll cook tonight for the man I love, phone calls from my friends, and a walk to the park, ignoring stares to clear my head. A day like any, like no other. Not so bad for the dead.
That's a wonderful poem.
Yeah.
Would you tell us why you like it so much?
Well, I think that it combines several things. You know, not only the autobiographical material and the fact of Tim's illness, but also his love of popular culture and movies, which occurs throughout his work. You know, from the very beginning.
That's a love you share.
And, yes.
Because you write a lot about that in your poems, too.
Yes. And in fact, Tim was very influential, had a big influence on me at the beginning. And I think he was one of the poets who really got me in touch with my love of popular culture and got me into writing about it.
Now, there's a poem of yours I'd like to hear. And it's a poem about Tim. And it's called Driving Back from New Haven. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the circumstances that you wrote this poem.
I wrote the poem Driving Back from New Haven in 1988. I had just moved to New York from Los Angeles, and Tim had just moved from New York to New Haven, where he was enrolled in the Yale Divinity School. And he drove me up to New Haven and showed me around and then drove me back to Manhattan. And this is about the trip back to Manhattan. Driving back from New Haven. Tim looks at his watch, reaches into his pocket, takes out a small plastic container, and swallows an AZT pill with a sip of Sprite. Poison, he mutters under his breath. I glance over at him. We haven't talked about his health the entire trip. How does it make you feel, I ask. Like I want to live until they discover a cure, he snaps. We travel in silence for a while. I stare out the window at all the green trees on the Merritt Parkway. Then he says, I resent it. I resent that we were not raised with an acceptance of death, and here it is, all around us, and I resent it. I resent that we do not know how to die.
Do you remember what you said to Tim after he said that?
You know, I don't. And I'm pretty sure that that's a pretty accurate description of what we talked about. But when I showed it, I sent it off to Tim after I wrote it with a note saying, please like this. and he responded and said that he did indeed like the poem, which was a relief. And I think he was surprised. I remember him saying that he was surprised that he was so angry or sounded so angry in the poem.
How much of your writing has been about AIDS?
Very little, actually. This is one of the few poems I have that where I directly address it. I think it sort of seeps between the lines in ways that I don't even know about. But it's a very painful subject, and I've lost many friends and peers to AIDS. So I don't think it's something that I've, you know, fully explored yet in my own work.
Is it a subject you just as soon not write about and that you feel is being well-served already?
Partially, yes. I feel that there are many poets who have been sick, who have written about it, or who have lost lovers, you know, and written about that, the pain of that loss. I just assume that someday I probably will write about it, but it's just too painful to tackle yet.
David Trinidad recorded 1 year ago. His poem, Driving Back from New Haven, is included in his latest book, Answer Song, published by High Risk. Trinidad is the editor of the forthcoming book, Powerless, Selected Poems, 1973 to 1990, by Tim Dugos. It's due out in the spring from High Risk and will include the poem, DOA. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The interviews we've heard on this archive edition of Fresh Air were first broadcast last year on World AIDS Day. We'll conclude today's show with a story we heard yesterday from the writer Felice Bacano about stumbling upon a list that he wrote in 1984. On it were the names of the 75 people who had attended his 40th birthday surprise party, which was thrown by his friends Vito Russo, the author and activist, and Clovis Ruffin, the fashion designer. Bacano was a member of the early gay writers group, the Violet Quill. After the members' manuscripts were bought by Yale University Library a couple of years ago, he was sorting through his work, shaking out his journals for loose papers.
And I found this list, and I took a look at it, and it was the thank you list. I wrote thank you cards because these people gave me gifts, you know. So these were not all of the people that I was close to, but most of the people that I was close to. Some people were out of town or, you know, in different places or couldn't make the party. But these are the most people who are closest to me. And there were about 75 people. It was a big party. It was a great party. We had a terrific time. It was very warm in February, so we were able to go out on the roof. And it was a beautiful night. And everybody had a great time. So I took a look at this list, and I said to myself, just off the top of my head, I wonder how many of these people are still alive. And I went down the list. There was one person who I could not account for his where he is at all. And of everybody else on the list, they were all dead. So it was 74 names.
When you found the list and were thinking about all your friends who have died, who did you call to tell about it? Did you have a desire to call?
By mm-hmm. then, my partner had died. There was no the person I would say. I would call him at work and say, I found this list and you'll be so amazed, but there's nobody left to call. That's what's happened for me. There really is nobody, because nobody will understand that. I don't know if anybody can. Yeah. Because it wasn't just authors and famous people. It was my attorney. It was my CPA. It was the guy who sold me my newspapers every day. It was my barber. It was the guy who fixed my shoes on the corner. You know, it really was everybody. This affected everybody. You know, and luckily for many years I was living in, you know, what was pretty much a gay world, and it got decimated piece by piece by piece. My banker at my local bank, who was gay, also died of AIDS.
Do you have a word for this incredible loss?
Well, I dread to use the word Holocaust because it has another context and meaning, but I can't think of anything that really comes close to it. It really was, for my group especially, it was pretty thorough and devastating Holocaust. It really got a lot of people. Got most of us, let's put it that way. I'd say of my group, it got 90% of us.
When you were looking at this list, realizing that the 75 people on it were now dead, did you think about being a survivor yourself?
Yeah, I did. I did think about being a survivor, and I wondered what it meant. And I remembered this one. There was this program called Shoah that was several years before.
A documentary on the Holocaust.
Yeah, which was a wonderful program. But there was one thing that was very startling. There was a sort of youngish man. He was, for a survivor, he was living in Israel, and he had been a barber. And he talked about how when he was a teenager, 13, 14 years old, he ran with the Polish resistance in the Warsaw ghetto, and they used to go through all the tunnels and everything and bring in food and medicine and whatever. And they kept on doing this, and he would spend nights outside of the ghetto. And one night they returned, and the ghetto was empty. Everybody was gone. And he said, that because the Nazis had taken them away, right? And he said, I felt like the last Jew on earth. And I thought that was so poignant at the time. This was like in 1986 or something when this thing was aired. And when I looked at that list, I thought, this has happened to me. This, the thing that I feared the most has happened to me. And then the other thing I thought is, I can't believe that I've escaped this, and I'm going to be all alone when I die because all my friends have died. There'll be nobody left to help me. And that's turned out not to be the case, luckily.
Are you sick yourself?
No, I'm not. I'm totally negative.
Good. Do you have a different circle of friends now?
Well, I've moved to another city. I'm outside of New York City because there really were too many ghosts there. It was really getting to me. It was depressing me. And I moved to Los Angeles where I have a new group. Well, I'm slowly putting together a new group of friends. It'll never be the same. I mean, these were people we grew up together. We were young together. We were young artists together, which is a special bond, young writers together. And we fought all the political battles. And, we were each other's firsts, So it'll never be the same.
You must be a pretty gregarious person if you had 75 friends coming to a party.
Well,
people can say that.
I was lucky for a long time. I mean, I really was. And they were really, every single one of them was interesting.
Are you a different kind of person now that so many of your friends have died and you've moved to a new city to get away from the ghosts?
Yeah, I am. Now I tend to deal with people more one-on-one, rather than in large parties. Also, a lot of that has to do with the time. People like to associate and have big parties at the time, and now they don't, But I get a lot more value out of my friends now. I tend to take them for granted because I thought they would always be there.
Felice Bacano spoke to us from L.A. His recent books include The Gay 90s and Like People in History, A Gay American Epic. Throughout this World AIDS Day program, we featured music from the CD Last Night When We Were Young, an album of ballads produced by pianist Fred Hirsch for Classical Action Performing Arts Against AIDS. We'll close with Hirsch playing Last Night When We Were Young. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our World AIDS Day program was produced by Phyllis Myers. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.